From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll speak with two people with Washington ties who took part in this week's International Climate Summit in San Francisco.
Then we learn how a Milwaukee woman became one of Hitler's most wanted.
They were very aristocratic. He could not believe that people like this would betray him, that they would work so hard to thwart his ideology.
Essayist Avi Lank reflects on his first lesson of defining news in the recent age of fake news.
News is whatever an editor says it is. Our professor smiled and nodded. That is what she had been aiming us at all along. And in my subsequent career, I never found a better definition.
And we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. In 2015, the United Nations convened the 21st Annual Climate Change Conference in Paris, France. Hundreds of people gathered, not only official delegates, but people like Clay Nessler as well. Nessler is Vice President of Sustainability with Johnson Controls.
2015 in Paris was very significant because countries came together and agreed on a new approach, which would address the challenge of climate change and try to keep temperatures below the 2 degrees C limit. It was based on intended nationally determined contributions in that each country essentially came up with a plan and a commitment or a commitment range of what they would contribute collectively to achieving that 2 degree target.
Another Wisconsin attendee was La Crosse-based pediatrician Jeff Thompson, CEO emeritus of Gunderson Health System. Gunderson has dramatically reduced its carbon footprint in recent years.
We define the health as both your physical health, how you breathe, how your heart's working, whether you have asthma attacks or not, but also economic health. And so we said we will stop hurting our patients and our community with the pollution generated from our energy sources. And we would do it in a way that would save the system money and improve the local economy.
President Trump has withdrawn from the Paris Climate Agreement, but international meetings continue to push plans forward, and with Americans like Thompson and Nessler still at the table.
San Francisco hosted a summit this past week, and Dr. Thompson and Clay Nessler were both in attendance. Lake Effect Susan Ben spoke with each of them by phone before they headed west.
We'll hear first from Johnson Controls' Clay Nessler. Back in 2015, Susan met him in Milwaukee, where Nessler described his company's approach to sustainability. Now based in Washington, D.C., Nessler gave Benz a preview of some of the innovations that are featured at the summit.
There's a new initiative called Science-Based Targets, where essentially you use the best climate science available to identify what goals within your industry sector should you target in order to contribute on a fair and equitable basis to the mitigation of climate change. So we're at this point, we've improved the energy productivity of our operations, which is the amount of revenue generated per BTU or gigajoule of energy use by over 90%. So this is something that we have committed to early as a company. We've set aggressive goals. We've met those goals ahead of schedule, and we will continue in the future to make goals very consistent with what we are able to do practically, as well as setting goals that are what is really required to achieve the targets of the Paris Agreement.
So back to the science-based targets, where did that formula or their template come from?
There's a number of organizations working together to work with organizations to help them define what are called science-based targets for carbon reduction within your own footprint, your use of electricity, your use of gas, the transportation fuel use of your fleets. But they also include being able to influence your supply chain, both the embodied energy and carbon in the materials that you would source to manufacture your products, as well as the impact of your products through use and end of life. It's so a very rigorous approach. And one of the big objectives of the Global Climate Action Summit is the chairman of Mahindra challenged other companies to set science-based targets with a goal of 500 organizations committing to set those targets in the future. We are one of those companies. And I don't know if we've hit 500, but I know we were very close last week. So stay tuned on that.
Is that then going to be the centerpiece of your conversations with people when at the summit, this particular target?
To some extent, yes. That is something that is certainly new and incremental, which we are bringing forth. But there's something called the Carbon Smart Buildings Day, which I'll be involved in and speaking at, which is really focused on a particular sector, the building sector. And of course, that's near and dear to our technology and solutions business based in Milwaukee. And the discussion there will be how can the building sector contribute what it could and should towards the Paris goals, with a very high and ambitious goal of having all new construction in 2030 be net zero carbon, and plans to convert existing buildings into net zero carbon by 2050. These are very aspirational goals, but exactly the kind of thing which makes people think differently about the issue. A lot of the carbon in the construction industry is actually in the materials, the steel, the cement that are used to build new buildings. And of course, many of those buildings are being built outside the United States, in China, India, and other developing countries. So there's a ripple effect of really addressing buildings, not only making a more efficient, greater use of renewable energy, energy storage can make their operation more efficient, but we're thinking even broader about how to reduce the amount of carbon or energy used in the materials, and potentially someday maybe even being able to store some of that carbon in the materials. And buildings are expected to have to contribute almost half of the greenhouse gas reductions over the 2050 time period. So that is a very great priority for many in the industry and most of the countries that are focused on the Paris Agreement.
When we talked what seems like a long time ago in 2015, you mentioned that the private sector is important to solving climate change challenges. And you talked about some governments being far more aggressive in their goals and their involvement than others. What's your read on the balance of the importance of those two?
Yeah, so at least in the buildings area, which we're closest to at Johnson Controls, a lot of the action takes place in cities. That's where building codes are established and enforced. That's where the construction is. The improvements that we need to make are very local. Someone has to come in and insulate a home. They have to replace incandescent bulbs with LED bulbs. All that work happens locally. And it's local leadership at a city and in some cases a state level that really drive the improvements. Government's a very broad term, and I think we see a lot of leadership. I think we see a lot of ambition, and I think we see a lot of impact coming from cities, which, you know, with urbanization and with the rising middle class, particularly outside the U.S., I think there's great urgency and relying on city and local governments to show the leadership there.
So you're not spending time knocking on doors at Capitol Hill?
I still spend time knocking on doors in Washington. We work very closely with the Department of Energy, with the State Department on international issues, with the Environmental Protection Agencies. Those programs are still underway. I just got back from the Better Buildings Summit in Cleveland, Ohio, which is a very large DOE event. Much of the activities that were created over, in some cases, decades are business as usual and moving forward. And we look to where the leadership is and where the greatest impact can be made.
Clay Nessler is Vice President of Sustainability with Wisconsin-based Johnson Controls. Dr. Jeff Thompson was also present at the 2018 Climate Summit in San Francisco. Thompson is CEO Emeritus of Gunderson Health System.
He talked about the process through which Gunderson has become more environmentally responsible.
So we set out on that journey from 2008 to 2014-15, right in that time period, we were able to drop our pollutants. Are pollutants that asthmatics breathe and heart patients breathe and adult lung patients have to breathe in by 95%, the amount of mercury that's put out in the environment from burning coal by 95%. And we made money, and we did it all with locally sourced energy supply that boosted the local economy. So we're able to do all those things, which is why they asked us to present our story at the Climate Talks in Paris and many other places around the country and around the world. To say, look, this is how a healthcare organization takes care of its community.
So I listened in on a Live from Paris event in which you participated. I think it was during the Paris event in December 2015. And you mentioned then that it's obvious, but not to everyone, that health and climate change are tied together, that also social justice and climate change are intertwined.
Oh, it's very true. You know, like all major struggles, and climate change is listed by virtually everyone that measures it. I mean, geopolitical folks as well as climate people as one of the great struggles of this coming century. It's almost always the least advantaged that get hurt the most. So when the giant heat waves come, it's people that can't afford air conditioning or in marginal situations. They can't afford it's either air conditioning or food, or their medicines. Which do they spend their money on? Because they don't have enough for everything. It is in floods and the people with the least amount of assets that are usually hurt the most. And they don't have generators, and they don't have ways to get out, and they don't have other options. So in times of climate-related migration events, we've seen many places in the world after terrible droughts or terrible flooding. It's those with the least assets that get hurt the most. And so it is, it's going to affect all of us. And even the people that say, well, I'm not in that category. I'm really fine. I'm going to be fine. The truth is the money used to take care of these extreme weather events or the increase in mosquito and other vector-borne illnesses, the effects from bad air quality that kill millions in the world every year, that money could be used for other things. It could be used for roads. It could be used for schools. It could be used for lower taxes. It could be used for a lot of other things. So we just feel that it's a responsible corporate citizen to do that, and that's one of the things that this Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco is going to be about. Is it's not just healthcare organizations, although it'll be many from around the world, but there'll be major businesses around the United States and the world saying this is exactly what we need to do as responsible community and national citizens to take this on.
So in 2015, you said government or governments can't be responsible for fixing all of the elements that contribute to climate change, but it can smooth the pathway. So do you think that's possible in our current political climate here in the United States?
Oh, sure. I think it is. It's just a different group has to take responsibility instead of expecting a president to lead on this for the long-term good of the whole population. It's just not happening. So other people have to rise up. Corporations can rise up. So states can rise up. Individual organizational groups, Healthcare Without Harm is a national, international organization that organizes health systems. I mean, healthcare is 18% of the United States GDP. If we all get organized towards improving the health of the population broadly, how we source all of our equipment, how we source all our medications, how we use and produce energy, we can have a huge impact. So just sitting back and whining because the president doesn't agree with this is taking the wrong path, in my opinion. And so we just need to take it on.
So you're heading out to San Francisco. What will your role be there, and what do you hope could come out of these discussions?
There's the Global Climate Action Summit. Then there's dozens of other convenings around that gathering. So there's a healthcare one. There's a broader roundtable, an international roundtable that has healthcare. The World Health Organization is there. People from India and China. I'll be on a panel with a leader from China, a leader from India, one from the National Health Service of England, who've done some terrific work to try and understand their impact on their communities. And so we'll do a couple things. Most of all, we'll kind of share best practices. Here's what we did. Here's how we did it. Here are the barriers we had. Here's how we overcame them. So it can be shared with other people around the world. But we'll also try and build paths forward and say, how do we as a group put pressure on international organizations or the international treaties not necessarily political, but get information out to the media so there's a clearer understanding of what the pathway forward could look like. So with a combined power of the governmental agencies that are there and healthcare sector and the IT sector and the business sector, there's a big banking sector that's there that see the impact of disastrous climate on many of their investments. So we put all these sectors together and share best ideas from each one and then develop plans to move forward to say what action do we need to take ourselves and what can we encourage others to do to more quickly move this forward.
Dr. Jeff Thompson is CEO Emeritus of La Crosse-based Gunderson Health System. He attended this week's Climate Summit in San Francisco. He spoke with Susan Benz, and you can read more at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break and then chat with writer Kay Nolan about the legacy of Milwaukee's Mildred Fish Harnack. That's when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. September 16th in Wisconsin is Mildred Fish Harnack Day. Harnack played a key role in the resistance effort during World War II, and she was executed by the Nazi regime for it. But many Wisconsinites today don't know who Harnack was or why the Milwaukee native's birthday should be honored.
I first spoke with reporter Kay Nolan when she wrote A Rebel Named Mildred for the January issue of Milwaukee Magazine in 2015, and she recalled then the moment when she first knew of Harnack.
I first learned of Mildred Fish Harnack back in 2002 after Daniel Pearl, who was a Wall Street Journal reporter, was kidnapped and beheaded in Pakistan by Al-Qaeda. And this was just a very shocking story to Americans and, particularly the barbaric seeming way in which he was executed. So I was searching for information about him, and I must have typed in American writer beheaded or something like that, and I stumbled across the story of Mildred Fish Harnack, and I saw that she was from Wisconsin, born and raised in Milwaukee, and I was amazed that I had never heard of her. And then in 2011, Milwaukee held its first Doors Open Milwaukee, which is a weekend in which the public is invited to tour historical landmarks and other significant buildings. And as part of this, I visited the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, and I walked in and they had an amazing, very detailed display about Mildred Fish Harnack, complete with photos and letters that she had written and so forth. So I kind of assumed that maybe other people did know about her and I just hadn't somehow gotten the story. But last summer, we had another incident in which James Foley, who was an American journalist, was kidnapped and beheaded by ISIS. And he had been to Marquette University. So there were lots of news stories here about him. People were writing in and talking to the media and posting comments online about how they maybe had met him or they knew him or they had also attended Marquette and they just couldn't believe that someone with Wisconsin roots was in this situation. And I watched to see if anybody would mention Mildred Harnack. And nobody did. And then I realized that maybe people don't know about her. So that's when I approached Milwaukee Magazine editors, and they agreed right away that people should be alerted to this amazing story.
Why is she worth knowing about?
She is such an inspiration. She was a very courageous woman who used the power of words to fight a great injustice. She was an inspiration to all of us. I mean, who doesn't like to fantasize that they could go on YouTube right now or go on social media and make a difference? And if they had inside knowledge that could help America fight ISIS or fight other injustice, who wouldn't want to be able to share that? And she did that, but she did that in a way that was extremely risky to her life and in the end cost her life.
Well, let's go back to her beginnings. She was born in Milwaukee around the turn of the 20th century. What do we know about her early life in Wisconsin?
Well, she grew up in Milwaukee. She attended what was called West Division High School. It's now known as Milwaukee High School of the Arts. She then went to what is now UWM. It was called Milwaukee Normal School at the time. And then she went on to graduate school at UW-Madison. So when you think about it, this was the 1920s. Most people did not go to college, especially most women did not. So she was very smart. She was very intellectual. She was passionate about learning, and she wanted to become an educator herself. She wanted to talk to people about great literature. She had a flair for languages, and she wanted to interpret this literature into other languages. And in fact, in her last days, when she was in prison awaiting execution, she continued to translate the works of a famous German author into English. And this is how she comforted herself in her final hours.
She met her husband in Wisconsin, but he was not from here.
That's correct. Arvid Harnack was, again, a brilliant person. He had earned a Rockefeller scholarship to study in the United States. So he was at UW-Madison, but he was from a very prominent and very educated German family. His father was a college professor, a historian. His uncle was a fairly well-respected theologian at the time. And they met and married here in Wisconsin. And eventually they returned to Germany in 1929. And at the time, she went after her doctorate. He earned two doctorates. He was an economist, but he also had a doctorate in law and a doctorate in philosophy. So their circle of friends were professors, doctors, lawyers, writers. At the time, stage theater was very prominent. You know, movies were just kind of getting off the ground. And prominent writers would write about current events and make them into stage plays. And this was an important way to spread information. And so they were acquainted with prominent playwrights, producers, actors, actresses in the theater, and musicians, you know, that type of society.
And these were all significantly people who generally were opposed to Hitler in his rise to power.
Yes, and this is what I found very interesting, because I think there was kind of a hole missing. Growing up learning about the Nazis, I think the message was presented that most German people went along, that they all kind of bought into the Nazis and into Hitler. And I think many of us wondered, well, really, how about the people that were the most educated, the people who were in the inside circles and could see what was going on? Did they really not object? Was nobody doing anything? But because we didn't know about it, we didn't know that there were people like this. I think we all knew the story of Sound of Music and Georg von Trapp, who was a baron and very educated, and he resisted, although, at least according to the movie, he mostly escaped and refused to help them. But to find out that there really were people who resisted, who actively worked to thwart the Nazis, is very inspiring and very reassuring.
Well, and now they were a part of a movement called the Red Orchestra. What was the Red Orchestra doing? What did Mildred Fish Harnack and her husband do as part of the resistance as Hitler was coming to power?
The Red Orchestra was the Germans' kind of nickname for a group of resistors who tried to get secret information to Allied powers, to the Soviet Union, to the United States, to England, and also tried to spread the word to other German citizens about what the Nazis were really up to, the fact that they were assembling concentration camps, that they were executing mass numbers of people, and that they really did want to take over the world. At the time, the news was censored, and people did not have access to what was really going on. So they typed up flyers with anti-Nazi news, anti-Nazi messages. There were clergy at the time who were giving sermons against this, so they would copy these sermons and distribute them. They also used their positions of influence in society to obtain visas and passports for Jews so that they could escape. And they also translated works into their various languages for workers who were maybe Polish or Czech or French and that were being forced to work in the Nazi camps, so that they could also receive this information. So they used their positions of power and influence in the best possible way. Arvid Harnack got himself a position in the economic ministry. He joined the Nazi party just in order to become an insider. And he had access to top secret information. He had access to information as to where the army planned to make its move, what kind of equipment they had, where this equipment was located. And he also was a brilliant mathematician, so he was able to figure out a very elaborate code system that was extremely hard to break and code this information and distribute it to other countries, people in power, and to try to see what he could do to turn the tide.
This was stuff that had a real impact.
It did. The Red Orchestra is credited with helping turn the tide against the Nazis, particularly by informing the Soviet Union of how the Nazis planned to attack so that they could be prepared and they could prevail.
They were able to keep up this work until 1942-43. Arvid was executed fairly quickly, but you write that Hitler himself paid special attention to Mildred's prosecution.
Yes, that's correct. She was originally sentenced to several years of hard labor, but Hitler was absolutely furious and baffled that the people that he thought were just the epitome of superior Germans, that they would actually betray him in this way. Arvid and Mildred just happened to be tall and blonde and very Nordic looking. And many of the Red Orchestra people fit this description. And he just could not believe that anybody of this.
He took it personally.
Right. I think Adolf Hitler took it very personally and was absolutely aghast that people that he considered to be role models for what he thought the perfect German should be, educated, Mildred and Arvid happened to be tall and blonde and Nordic looking. They were very aristocratic. He could not believe that people like this would betray him, that they would work so hard to thwart his ideology. He wanted them to suffer the worst possible sentence, which was death, and he wanted it to be done in the worst possible way. And he made sure that Mildred and some other women were in fact executed.
They were executed by guillotine, you're right.
Yes, that's correct. They were led to the guillotine. Mildred's last words were, "And I have loved Germany so much." And she was beheaded.
So what has been done over the years to bring attention to Mildred Fish Harnack?
Initially, after World War II, not much was done to honor the Harnacks or anybody in the Red Orchestra. And And there were a couple reasons for this. First of all, it was the Cold War era. And anybody who was even associated with the Soviet Union or with communists or helping communists were considered un-American, undemocratic, not the type of people that we wanted to honor at the time. The other thing is that the news at the time was censored, and people really didn't know the extent of this resistance movement. The people in the movement, of course, took great pains to keep everything secret and to cover their tracks. We didn't have the internet at the time. Mildred's own family back in Milwaukee did not find out for several months that she and her husband had been executed. And when they did, all they got was the official German line, which said that they had committed treason and therefore were executed. It really wasn't until the fall of the Iron Curtain that a great many documents detailing the resistance movement, including the Red Orchestra, began to come to light, and scholars and journalists began discovering these details and getting the message out there. And a certain group of people in Wisconsin, including an attorney named Art Heitzer, who talked to me for this article, tried to bring Mildred Fish Harnack's story to light. And they succeeded in getting the legislature in 1986 to name September 16th as Mildred Fish Harnack Day in the schools.
And that's her birthday.
That is her birthday.
And beyond that, there was a movie made just a few years ago. But still, to this day, it seems like an underreported story.
It seems that way. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction does continue to name September 16th as Mildred Fish Harnack Day, and they will, you know, post it as such on their website and on Twitter. But they do not track or monitor what individual schools do. And it's not clear that many students are learning about Mildred Fish Harnack. And that's really a pity. I mean, think of the millions of Wisconsin students that have gone to school in the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s and the 1980s that, and even now, that could know about this very inspiring story.
Freelance reporter Kay Nolan wrote about Mildred Fish Harnack for the January issue of Milwaukee Magazine back in 2015. September 16th is known in Wisconsin as Mildred Fish Harnack Day. You can find a link to Nolan's story at WUWM.com.
A Lake Effect essayist considers the definition of news in the fake news era when Lake Effect Weekend returns in a moment on WUWM.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Fake news has been a common phrase from the White House since President Trump first began his term. However, Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank notes that there's a big difference of claiming something as fake news or claiming it is false news.
Lank is a former journalist, and he reflects on one of his first lessons about how the world defines news.
Fake news is an oxymoron. One of the favorite talking points of President Trump cannot logically exist. Let me explain. Back in 1971, when I passed a long, hot summer sweltering on the shores of Lake Michigan, beginning my graduate journalism studies at Northwestern University, the first assignment of my first class was to come prepared to discuss the nature of news. The object, the professor told us, was to define what news is. So, for an hour, a dozen bright young minds explored the subject from every conceivable angle. Was news the proceedings of the Common Council? The congressman on the take? The fatal traffic accident down the street? The dalliances of a movie star? The score of last night's hockey game? A review of a new play? The election or the death of a pope? Something that is so cute it becomes what is today known as a meme, but when I was in college would cause a man to put down his morning paper, hand it over to his wife with a silly grin and say, "Hey Marge, look at this." These were just a few of the examples we discussed. Our careful attempts to find a definition that covered all of them failed. Finally, one of my classmates, who had been trained in logic at a Jesuit university, offered this definition. News is whatever an editor says it is. Our professor smiled and nodded. That is what she had been aiming us at all along. And in my subsequent career, I never found a better definition. Although as the media world has expanded, I would update it to news is whatever the gatekeeper of a news site decides to present. It makes no difference if that gatekeeper is an editor at the New York Times, a producer at Fox News, or Alex Jones of InfoWars. What each decides to place before the public is news, and therefore cannot be fake news. It can be false news. But even false news is not fake news, because news is what an editor says it is. False news is if they say something that is untrue. It never occurred to me and my fellow grad students that an editor would consciously decide to present false information as news, and in a 40-year career, I never met one who did. That's why people have trust in outlets run by professionally trained journalists. Or did, until President Trump started to assert that things presented as news in outlets he dislikes are fake. But why does President Trump use the word fake rather than false when referring to the New York Times and CNN? He does so because if the Times itself is fake, then the unflattering things it presents as news about him can be ignored and vilified. Whether the individual story is true is beside the point. Logically, however, this will not wash. News is what a gatekeeper selects. If that news is untrue, then a president or anyone else can call it such and show why. Good editors will correct errors brought to their attention. But to call the New York Times fake is as illogical as calling Mr. Trump's regime a fake presidency.
Essayist Avi Lank is a former reporter for the Milwaukee Sentinel and later the Journal Sentinel. He's also co-author of the book, The Man Who Painted the Universe.
We will take one last break and then have our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal stories.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And that means, of course, it's time for another edition of Ex Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Rachel Owens, joined by Ex Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney. Good afternoon.
Hiya, how's it going?
It's going well. I just can't get enough of this weather.
Oh, I know. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's actually, this whole summer has been really wonderful as far as I'm concerned. And it's just keeping it going. So, you know, all those kids who are in school right now can sit there and just gaze out the window and see all the sunshine and daydream about their summer activities. But sorry, guys, you're back in school.
It's good to be an adult sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes, for sure. So today, I'm sure the theme has been exposed at this point. We are focusing on our teachers in school. I did bring a couple of stories today from people who had personal teaching experiences. So let's start out today's show with a story from our belonging event. This story is from Elena Olson Valdez.
Okay, so I'm originally from Madison, and over the summer I work with a summer school program. I'm not a summer school teacher, I just work in what would be after school during summer school. So it's 3 hours of the day, and we're with like a group of 10 to 15 second and third graders, for me at least. And I love it. I've done it for 3 years. It's a different experience every time. But this story is about belonging, I realized, because I wasn't sure what that meant. I knew, like, I know the definition of belonging, but when it came to thinking of a story, no story came to mind until I started listening to what people were saying and thinking about, well, what does rejection mean in terms of what does belonging mean? So the story qualifies. So my second year, I worked at this really big site, Sandberg Elementary School. There were a lot of kids, and it was really fun. And the first day, I remember we came in, and I was really excited, and we had brought the kids in from recess, and we were setting up the expectations and everything, so they were going to come in, and it was going to be nice, and they were going to sit in the circle and, you know, listen to what we had to say, I thought. And there are these two boys who came in, and I just watched the way that they walked in, and it was just like, I knew that they owned the room, you know, you could just feel that. And they walked in, and Chad, that's who this story is really about, came in, and he knocked, took his hand, and he just knocked this whole box of markers and crayons and everything. It wasn't mine, it was the teacher's whose classroom it was, knocked it right off the shelf. And I'm like smiling, you know, because I still have these other 12 kids who are doing pretty okay, and he's, you know, making a scene and everything. And I'm like, oh, Chad, you know, I didn't say it like that. I did not say it like that. But it's like, I gave him an option because that's really helpful for kids sometimes to give them an option, you know, like, well, I can clean it up and you can leave the room, or you can clean it up and decide where it's supposed to go. So that was my very first introduction to Chad. Later in that week, it's really fun because you get to, you learn about the students and you're learning what makes, or what is important to the individuals and what they like to do and how you can change the activities to make it important to them. You know, because not all kids like art and not all kids like going outside, and so you have to find that medium when you're playing kickball and there's, you know, three kids who are like, I don't want to play, this is stupid. So we were doing kites. It was like the third day in. And Chad was at his own table. He's a really smart kid, but didn't really want to do the art portion of it. And it's hard, you know, you have to take those, they're like wooden sticks, and then there's a piece of paper, and you have to tie it on there and everything. And I don't know, it was a really bad project, but we were doing it, and you can't just, like, give up. You have to try something. So everybody's trying something, and I'm really proud of them. They're doing a really great job, and Chad especially is, you know, I don't really want to do this, and he didn't say it like that either, trust me. So he's working at his table, and I'm being really encouraging because I find that I really like this kid, and I want him to do well and enjoy what he's doing. So, you know, I'm kind of keeping my eye out in all directions, making sure that I'm seeing everything, and I hear these other boys, and they're not really on task, and so I go over there, and they're drawing, but on their kites, because they're supposed to be drawing what they want, and they've drawn these women wearing basically nothing, and I kind of get into this, like, feminist rant, like, you can't do this, and I'm like, ah, you can't do this, you're talking to second graders, like, how can you put this into words? And so while this chaos is going on in this corner of the room, I realize in this corner of the room where Chad is, it's going nuts too, and it's because he's going, ah! And I had a co-leader, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention, Pahoa, who is going, Chad, Chad, can you stop? Chad, 3, 2, 1. And I'm like, I don't know what to do either. Like, I don't know, 3, 2, 1. I'm like, Chad, Chad. And so I just look at him and I go, ah! And I match his pitch. And then I hold up my fingers while I'm going, ah! And we cut out at the same time. And it was beautiful. And we belonged.
And that story was from Elena Olson Valdez.
I feel like I've used that technique once or twice.
The screaming versus screaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how, like, animalistic we become when we feel challenged as human beings. And, you know, some colors will be exposed at that point, I guess.
Just got to do what you got to do. So.
Yep. Yeah. It's like a survival technique. So we are in our season 10. This past week, we had our very first Story Slam of season 10. It was at Garfield's 502, and the theme was generations. And this was actually the first time we ever had a Story Slam on a Friday night.
Ooh.
We're bringing the date night to you with Exfabula on Friday nights now.
Friday Night Lights, a whole new meaning, huh?
Exactly. Of course, we still have them sprinkled on the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but this was so much fun to have that option. We also have new venues we're going to this year, some super secret surprises with Secret Fabulas, and we're just elated. I mean, 10 years. 10 years.
Ah, congratulations. And it does feel like it's been a long summer, a long wait for the new season to begin. So we're ready for that as well.
Well, great. Yeah, we're here for you, Milwaukee. So let's just bring it back to our next story. This one is from Jen Heppner, who told this particular story at one of our fellowship events where the theme was embracing cultural diversity.
I've spent a lot of time in educational settings throughout the years. I was a preschool teacher for many years. And then I went to UW-Madison and learned how to become a teacher, elementary school teacher, and I had site visits, and I was an assistant teacher, and then I was a teacher in my own classroom. And I remember a lot of these settings where one of the goals was to embrace cultural diversity. And you would walk into the school, and there would be flags of many different nations up on the walls, and that was good to see. And then they're in the books, like in the kindergarten classroom, you could see the faces of many different types of ethnicities and different languages, and people celebrated Chinese New Year and Dia de los Muertos and Black History Month. And, you know, it was like, okay, this is a good start, a good start. I did then experience many things that let me know that that was only a start, however, in the schools. One of the biggest things that I remember that let me know that that was only a start was an incident where I was an assistant teacher at a kindergarten. The teacher and I found out someone had peed all over in the boys' bathroom, and it was just a mess. And she was adamant that she wanted to find out who it was and make that student clean up the mess. And so we discovered that there was one boy who had been seen coming out of the bathroom about the time that we thought the incident had occurred, and she started to question him. And during her questioning, she's looking at him in the face, and he's looking to the left, and he's looking to the right, and he's looking up. And she stopped questioning him and started getting on him about making eye contact with her. "You look at me when I'm talking to you." And he still was looking everywhere but in her face, and she actually took his chin and turned it so that his face was right in her face. "You don't." And she just kept going on and on about it. And I had this gut-wrenching feeling in my stomach that something really awful was happening there. And I had a flashback to my time when I was in the Peace Corps in West Africa. And during our cultural training, we were taught that in the culture we were about to work in, it was considered very disrespectful to look at someone of authority in the eyes. So that if we met someone who looked like they might be older than us, or a government official, or someone of authority, we should avert our gaze. Which for me was hard because I was always taught you look at someone in the eyes to show respect. And I just thought, it could be that this is happening between the child and the teacher right now. I don't know, but the teacher was a white, middle-class female, and the student was a young Asian-American male. And I just thought, I don't know a lot about Asian culture, but it could be that this is happening. So I stepped in, and I just said to the teacher, "I think we might just be having a misunderstanding right now, and maybe we could wait and talk to this child's parents when they come to pick him up." And she took a deep breath and she stepped back, and she was still pissed, but she said, "Okay, we'll wait." And sure enough, when we talked to the student's parents, we found out that in fact he would have been in big trouble if his parents had found out that he had looked at the teacher in the eye during that scenario. In fact, it would have been the height of rudeness for him to do so. So he was really trying to be respectful and probably very scared and confused as to why was she saying, "Look at me in the eyes." And what it had never occurred to the teacher that there could possibly be it could possibly ever be disrespectful for him to look at her. It never occurred to her. So she misinterpreted him as being rude, not obeying, maybe not even very smart because he couldn't understand what she was saying. I'm sure he was interpreting her as a scary person, picking on him, mean, or whatever. So I had a number of these incidences. There were so many differences and misunderstandings with respect to what's the appropriate volume level. What's the appropriate way to issue a command? Is it okay to ask a question when you're issuing a command or not? Is it okay for multiple people to be talking at the same time? Or do you take turns and speak one at a time? So when I finally had my classroom, what I did is I sat down in a circle with all my students, and I just made this kind of stuff open, and we just talked about it. And I would say something like, now, in my culture, a lot of white middle-class women, when we're telling you what to do, and I'm the teacher and I will be telling you what to do, I might phrase it in a question like, Johnny, is that where the scissors go? Now, I'm not asking you, is that where the scissors go? Because I don't know, and I want you to tell me. I'm telling you to put the scissors away. And so then we'd go around the room, and the kids would educate me and each other on how, you know, how you tell someone what to do. And it, do you expect eye contact? And all of these things, so that at least we had an understanding of each other, and maybe that would decrease the types of misunderstandings that could occur. Thank you.
And that was Jen Heppner with her experience teaching and such. You know, I have to say, I honestly feel that every position, every job, every vocation that you could be in needs cultural diversity training. I mean, I just feel like this should be like the new MO for everybody.
Yeah, because you can't get away from it in the world these days.
Right.
We are a melting pot no matter where you are, and it's a beautiful thing. So why not embrace it and celebrate it?
Right. I mean, we're aware now. Let's do something about it.
Right.
You know? So that was Jen Heppner and Elena Olson-Valdez with their stories for today's teacher episode.
And of course, there's more Exfabula events coming because you've just started the new season.
Yes, thank you for reminding me. We have a general public storytelling workshop if you, Milwaukee, would like to hone up your storytelling skills. It's going to be at 6 p.m. on Monday, September 17th at AWE, which is Artists Working in Education on Valete Street. You can get your tickets. You can get everything storytelling related, including tickets to our next Story Slam, and find out more about our storytelling workshops at xfabula.org.
Thanks for getting the new season off to a great start.
Yay.
Here, Leah, and we look forward to more stories next week.
I want to just do a quick shout-out thank you to Milwaukee. Here we are. Let's get these stories rolling. Yay, season 10.
Woo. All right. Enjoy the beautiful weather this weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on Listener Supported, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. All Things Considered is next. It's 4 o'clock.